HPPodCraft.com.
Happy Thanksgiving, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a good one if you celebrate it. And thank you for joining us here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comments Show. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. When we last left off, we were looking at comments from Strange Eons. Why don't we look at some more of those?
Yeah.
Starting with Strange Eons Part 3.
Lord Marduk writes, Chad's reference to the Getty Villa was interesting. However, the description of the building once Kay had entered wasn't gone over. But once inside the room beyond the double doorway, familiarity faded. The huge chamber was only faintly illuminated by lamps recessed in panels bordering a high ceiling, and the ceiling itself bore no resemblance to the exterior outline of the building's circular dome. Instead, it rose from the walls in four triangular stone panels which slated sharply to meet a common apex above. They were standing in what seemed to be the interior of a hollowed-out miniature pyramid. This is another shout-out to the Shadow Crypt Pyramid, which is a crypt in a Los Angeles cemetery. I think the Rosedale Cemetery.
Yes.
It's a little,
that's right.
Little pyramid structure there. So yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what it was. Robert Bloch was clearly familiar with Southern California and working a lot of those references into the story.
So Caleb Shoggoth Lord Long says, Lovecraft being the most aptly named of all writers likely refers to the fact that he loved his craft and would take much time and great care in assembling the plots and prose of his tales.
Ah, yeah, that's probably what was meant by that.
Allison Albright writes, well, I don't know how everyone else does things, but I knew my husband was the guy I'd marry when I realized he'd been recording me while I slept.
Oh, really? I guess that wasn't that odd.
There you go.
Much more common than I thought. Bob Sharp writes, I might be wrong, but I think the whole science and magic speech was just Bloch's much less elegant phrasing of Arthur C. Clarke's any sufficiently advanced technology quote. As in, there's science and there's magic, but there's a good chance that somebody else's science might be our magic. Just a thought. It's the correct thought, Bob. I think that's exactly what he tried to get across there. But as you write, it was much less elegant phrasing. And also in odd places that it didn't quite make sense thematically. So
no. I know. Yeah. I think I know what he meant. But
yeah, I do
that's
too.
Not what he wrote.
That's right.
Steve says it's Reverend Nye the Cthulhu guy.
Hey, it's a possible Netflix show.
Yeah.
Jesse Jacoby writes an exemplary Blocktober whisper. Thank you. You're very welcome. I had forgotten that was something we used to do, and so we worked it into that third episode.
Blocktober.
It's branding. It's Blocktober branding.
Blocktober. Mm. Aaron Levine writes, I started a year ago listening to this podcast. Now I'm here, caught up. I have to wait a week for the next episode. The struggle is going to be so real.
I know that feeling.
I've been there.
Catch up to something, yeah.
Doing some binge watching on Netflix, and then there's a show you watch two or three seasons, and then the show that's on is just on weekly, and you're like, what?
Like, did I travel through time? This sucks. Eric W. Mertz writes, regarding The Night Ocean by Repairer of Reputations, I bought the record and like how it feels in my work/creative space. Thanks for picking that up. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
When you support our sponsors, you're definitely supporting the show. He says, thank you for the introduction. I'm curious about your thoughts on the proliferation of Lovecraft imagery and music, particularly the many types of metal. Write a lot of music reviews and I'm exposed to a wide variety of what the genre has to offer. Similar to fiction, there seems to be a subgenre forming in metal that uses Lovecraft stories and creations. I happen to think that, save for a few cases, it's a cheap grab at name recognition. But there are definitely artists who work well with Lovecrafty motifs in their heavy music. Yeah, agreed. I think we've talked about that a lot.
Yeah.
I personally feel that folks who are interested in metal are probably just reading that kind of stuff, so it's a natural thing for them to be writing about it.
Yeah.
But it's also a good way to avoid emotion, you know, if you don't want to put any emotion in your music, sing about some Lovecraft.
Well, I don't know about that.
I am kidding.
No, I just think that
I'm embarrassed by feelings. Nyarlathotep.
I think these guys, like you said, they're reading this stuff. They're into it. If you're into Lovecraft, it can be a little mind-blowing. It could kind of set you off in a cool way, and that is definitely something you would like to express in music if you're a musician. So
yeah, totally. I'm kidding. Well, the thing is that metal actually, despite it's probably not thought of this way by non-fans, but it's an intellectual art form in a lot of ways.
Hmm.
It's a lot more likely that people are going to be singing about books or obscure things like Lovecraft than you would find, you know, in pop music. So yeah, I think that it just lends itself naturally to horror in general.
Lathis writes, if H.P. Lovecraft had been a pop star instead of an author, Strange Eons could have been a Broadway musical. Please, oh please, tell me how to get to this alternative universe. Wow, that would be one heck of a musical.
Yeah. Strange Eons Part 4, Sanjay Matthew writes, now that we're at the end, I have a question. Bloch's basically done a mashup of Lovecraft-esque, but not really Lovecraftian stuff here. Now the guys have been treating this quite sympathetically, whereas Derleth, who arguably did the same thing, is always in for scorn. I get that Bloch never claimed to be writing a collaboration with Lovecraft, as Derleth did, And in the end, the difference between bad and kitsch is subjective. But is this really any different from Derleth's work insofar as their place in the wider body of mythos-related fiction is concerned? Block, in his other works, shows himself a far more capable writer, technically speaking, than Derleth. But just from what Mr. Lehman has read out, this clearly isn't an example of Block at his best. Mm-hmm. Is that what makes the difference when actually reading these two texts? I mean, we have a good deal of fun reading the Derleth stuff as well.
Yeah,
I think you hit on it right away. I'm definitely more sympathetic towards Block because he's not claiming that Lovecraft wrote this with him.
Yes, exactly. Forrest Rush goes on to say, "To each their own, Sanjay, but I think Block's mashup is just fun, badly done, but fun, whereas Derleth's posthumous collaborations always seem to me to be self-serving, first financially and second reputationally."
Exactly.
"I know that ultimately Derleth must be thanked for saving HPL, for keeping his works in the public eye long enough for him to be discovered, and some may find it funny to suggest financial gain was upmost in August's mind, but I have always seen him as a kind of Salieri to H.P. Lovecraft's Mozart, which is, of course, very unfair to Salieri."
Yeah, I also don't think Derleth was trying to kill Lovecraft.
No. However, my biggest gripe with August Derleth is his attempt to put the Cthulhu mythos in a more structured format, some say more Christian style of good and evil.
Yeah. And then Frank Bailey writes, "I tend to think Block did this pretty tongue-in-cheek while Derleth was trying to step into his shoes and keep the franchise going." Agreed. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what the difference is.
So John Hancock, a reader on the show, big fan, he says, "As soon as I heard Andrew read the line, 'Don't think about it, don't ask questions,' I knew we were listening to Block desperately addressing his readers."
I think he's right. Bryn Mawr writes, "The reverend is nigh, you know, as in the end is nigh." Block had a sense of humor and is using it all over the place in this story.
Yeah.
E. Byron Nelson says, "A third option for what to do with the problem of Lovecraft stories existing in a post-Lovecraft mythos story, besides having Lovecraft be a prophet whose stories are true, or having an alternate universe where Lovecraft was never born, is to have Lovecraft be a mythos entity himself, such as the face of Nyarlathotep, or a man possessed by a Yithian, or just a Yog-Sothoth cultist. Lovecraft / Nyarlathotep's plan might be to popularize the ideas and beings in the Necronomicon by writing initially obscure weird fiction that grows in popularity over time, which might generate a kind of psychic energy for summoning the outer gods or something. But that leaves enough out or gets enough wrong so that the stories aren't actually helpful." This is basically how Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness deals with the problem. Sutter Kane, as a stand-in for Lovecraft, is actually an agent on behalf of the outer gods, bringing about the end of reality through his fiction. Yeah, I guess you could go that way. It's kind of a stretch.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Well, one thing that I haven't seen anybody do, not saying that nobody has done this, but I just haven't seen it, is that Lovecraft, I thought, always kind of made himself out to be the character Randolph Carter.
Sure, right. Oh, yeah.
If we suppose that Lovecraft actually did all those things that the character Randolph Carter did, you know, he had the silver key, he went and dug up a grave with Samuel Loveman, all those other kind of weird things that he does. Well, eventually he becomes an avatar of Yog-Sothoth, and then he goes into the body of a cockroach thing from the future and masquerades as the Swami Chandraputra.
Yes.
I want to see that story. That happened in our world. So anybody out there that feels like they need to do a Lovecraftian pastiche where Lovecraft is part of his writing, I want to see that.
I just want to hear you explain that character arc to somebody else who doesn't know anything about this stuff. Watch their reaction. That's some insane shit you just said.
Well, it is. It's totally insane. So Rafe Ball says, "After the marriage, would she be Cthulhu?" Ooh, yes.
Clever. Very clever, Rafe. Into the Halloween bonus content show that we did last month. Just talked about Halloween for a half hour's fun.
Yes, we did. And most people seem to like it, but I did get schooled on my pronunciation here. And of course, that's on me. Sam Hain.
A lot of people wrote in about that.
Yeah, yes. They said, "You did it wrong. It's actually pronounced so in." But also, I've seen it pronounced. There's a few pronunciations of this, different Irish and Gaelic pronunciations. There's Samhain, Shavin, Sowin. Also, Beltane is Beltina or Beltine.
Well, I was watching Sabrina, the Teenage Witch on Netflix, which is a pretty fun show. And they said Samhain. The same way we did, Samhain.
Yeah.
So I figure if you guys are so upset about this, take it up with them. They make way more money. Go bother Sabrina. Man, that show is satanic. I can't believe how satanic it is.
Yeah, well, they're getting sued by the Church of Satan because they used their statue.
Yeah, they used their statue of Baphomet on there. I noticed it when we were watching the show. I was like, oh, that's the one they put up every time, you know, there's a religious nativity scene somewhere.
Yeah.
I wonder how they're getting away with that. And apparently they're not.
I guess they're not.
Jamie Allenson wrote, thanks, guys. Really enjoyed this episode. As a child in Scotland in the 1980s, I remember doing Halloween the old way. My dad carved a lantern from a turnip. We bobbed for apples in a basin and then went guising around the town, performing for people who would then give us sweets.
Ooh.
I think mine was the last generation to do this, however. Scottish children now mark Halloween the American way, with pumpkins instead of turnips and implied threats of vandalism instead of performances. That's so American. It makes me a wee bit sad that these customs have now gone, probably forever, in the place that originally gave birth to them. That is sad.
It is sad, yeah.
Sounds like a lot of fun what they did.
So Alison Albright writes, many of the people I've known who are into horror definitely tend to be kind, sensitive, empathic people who generally want to make the world a little less awful any way they can. I'm definitely too soft for this world myself, and I think I use horror as a little inoculation against my own real fears, because there are a lot of them.
Yeah, I think so.
I agree.
Sanjay Matthew writes, as for Halloween-like celebrations in other cultures, in Chinese and many Chinese-influenced cultures, the seventh month of the lunar calendar is the month of hungry ghosts. I've heard of this before.
Oh,
it's basically a synthesis of Chinese folk belief with Buddhism. In Buddhism, you can be reborn as a preta, a spirit which eternally hungers but cannot eat. And in this existence, you basically burn off part of your karmic debt.
Oh.
That sounds terrible. Meanwhile, in Chinese folk religion, the spirits of your ancestors are meant to be honored.
Right.
Putting two and two together, this logically means that you better do your best to feed the spirits in case they're your ancestors. If not, as per Mulan, dishonor on you, your family, and your cow.
Oh, no.
During the seventh month, the gates of hell, not really hell in the Christian sense, but basically the netherworld, are opened and the spirits are released. There are huge feasts and song and dance performances put on for the hungry ghosts and lots of superstitions about not staying out after dark, if possible, and so forth.
Hmm.
In addition, they burn offerings, some of which are elaborate paper replicas of houses, cars, iPhones, etc.
Wow. We mostly focused on the West and actually Western Europe.
Sure.
Because that's what we know. But yeah, there seems to be a lot of very similar. I mean, it sounds kind of wacky, but there's a lot of things that are similar to our Halloween season.
Yeah. That's cool. The hungry ghosts.
Derek Sotak writes, friend of the show, Derek Sotak writes, you forgot to mention the greatest Halloween game of all, Snap Apple. The person running the game would take a long stick and dangle it from a smaller stick by a string. On one side of the small stick was stuck an apple, and on the other, a lit candle. This was then spun around, and the player, who was blindfolded, needed to try and bite the spinning apple and not get a face full of lit candle and hot wax.
My God.
What? And he puts a link to this, and there's actually a painting from the days of yore that shows this activity going on. And yeah, it's real. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
And now, you probably wouldn't get burnt too bad just from the lit candle. Like, as soon as you felt the heat, you'd pull away. But I'm just thinking, in my childhood, the Aquanet that everybody was wearing, you would have murdered so many young punk rocker kids, you know, the minute candle came anywhere near your face.
Poof.
Go up. Paul Meager writes, there was a hell house outside Philly in the late 80s that incorporated the satanic panic and had a human sacrifice being conducted by Dungeons & Dragons players.
Oh, wow.
With the player's handbook and monster manual being used as grimoires. As a longtime D&D player, I laughed my ass off. Yeah, I'd try and get in on that action too. Hey, you guys got an empty seat?
That's one of the things that always bug me about those people that think that D&D or witchcraft or any of those things are going to corrupt children, or they're going to take you away, because they don't do anything. Like, if D&D really allowed me to cast spells, like, that would be awesome. But it doesn't. It's just a flipping game. It's a silly storytelling game. I mean, just like all these things.
Yeah, man. Amber Reeves wrote, thanks for the shout out. I failed my sanity check and yelled across the office I work at.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I'm also glad you specified that it's the office you work at. And you didn't just run into some random office of people you don't know and yell. That would be quite shocking, I think.
Priyanka Chaudhary, I hope I pronounced that correctly, wrote, hey, my first ever comment on an episode, and I can't deny the Halloween temptation. Halloween is, of course, my favorite holiday, so this was a fun episode to listen to. I agree with the sentiment about horror lovers. I was scared of the dark and what scary stuff might be hiding in there for a very long time, and now I would self-describe myself as a bona fide horror movie buff. This doesn't happen with a lot of people, though, and I wonder why some people stay scared. On a side note, I turned 19, geez, this Thursday, which reminds me that I've been listening to this show for 6 years, on and off at least. How crazy is that? One, this show is a big part of my youth.
Oh, man.
Oh, no. And now my young adulthood. And two, I didn't even know who Lovecraft was before this. Ha ha. Sorry if that makes it feel old. Thanks for 6-ish years of exposure to weird fiction and good times. It does make me feel old.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel old, but then you know what? The great thing about aging is that it comes for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
You know, anytime someone seems smug about their youth, I go, just wait, buddy. You're going to regret the way you feel right now. But it's awesome that you did listen while you were a teenager and that you're still listening, even though you've got the wisdom of adulthood now.
Yeah.
Bryn Mawr writes, in Australia, Halloween is seen by many as an American tradition and therefore not something that is widely celebrated, at least not until recently. Now Halloween is becoming a growing concern with many stores carrying Halloween merch. We have a fledgling haunt industry and zombie walks are also increasing in popularity. I think Australia, with all of its horrifying spiders and wildlife, maybe that's the reason it's not so popular, because every day is kind of walking through. I started trick-or-treating as a child in the 80s after seeing E.T., which didn't scare me, but the Vorpal Bunny and Love at First Bite did.
The Vorpal Bunny from Monty Python's The Holy Grail.
Yes, of course, and Love at First Bite. Is that the Jim Carrey movie?
No, that was...
Oh, that's George Harrison,
that's
right?
George...
Not George Harrison. That's George Hamilton, right?
Yes.
George Hamilton. That's a good one.
That was scary? But I don't even remember being scary about that.
It's scary that Dracula could have that deep of a tan. Because people didn't really know much about trick-or-treating back in the 80s, they madly scrambled to find something to give us kids. The funniest thing I ever got given was a donkey statue that, when you pulled its tail, crapped out cigarettes. Great gift for a 10-year-old. That is a great gift for a 10-year-old. That's amazing.
Wow.
I hope you kept that. Stephen Moore wrote, Chad kills me. I love him. Red leather thriller jacket worn to school. Good teachable moment, you would think. But no, I think a vampire short cape is a thing to wear now. I know, man.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to go through it a few times before you learn.
It's true.
Christina Taylor Berry writes, Welsh villages used to keep a special horse's skull buried during the year before digging it up around winter solstice, putting it on a pole, and then a small group of men make the rounds to people's houses to terrorize / entertain them in exchange for hospitality. This would happen during Christmas time, but is related to trick-or-treating and, to me, equal parts disturbing, fascinating, and awesome.
Yeah.
Pictures of the skull pole contraption are a bit terrifyingly goofy.
That's weird.
I read about that when I was doing my research for on Halloween, but it just it seemed a little too far because, like she said, it happens mostly around Christmas time. So I was like, I don't know if I could really include that. But hey, comment show.
That's what it's for. Matthew Buston writes, this show makes up for Chad's Vincent Price skit in the last episode.
What? I know Matthew did not like Vincent Price, lying Vincent Price, but a lot of people did.
A lot of people did. That comment cut me deep. I got to admit it did. But the next week we had comments on our comments show and Stephen Vincent wrote in, I love lying Vincent Price. Please keep him for every show. Thank you, Stephen Vincent. And the Screaming Moist wrote, lying Vincent Price might be my favorite thing you guys have ever created. Okay, that's a little overboard. But the praise was welcome.
Well, you guys, I have no part in that. That's all Chad Pfeiffer. You get full credit and blame.
For good or bad, yeah.
Exactly. For lying bits of price.
Moving on to Povember, Hop Frog.
Devin Moore says, I first became acquainted with the concept of Hop Frog when I saw the Roger Corman adaptation of The Mask of the Red Death, in which someone dresses up as a gorilla and gets burned alive by Hop Toad. I don't know. Why did they change the name?
What a stupid... Yeah, and why didn't they go all the way and they call him Jump Toad or something? Just go all the way with it if you're getting lame.
I don't get it. Anyway, back to what Devin wrote here. Regarding the recurrence of orangutans, the offending ape in the Murders of the Rue Morgue was also changed to a chimpanzee in a few films, such as Argento's Phenomena. I assume that filmmakers either discriminated against orangutans or simply recognized them for the lovable stoners they are.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Hop Frog is my favorite Poe story. It was adapted in 1992 by Julie Taymor as a made-for-TV short film entitled Fool's Fire, possibly the only way to make Poe's story more badass, with Michael J. Anderson, the groovy backwards-talking guy from Twin Peaks, playing Hop Frog.
Yes.
James Ensor, Belgium's famous painter, also made some really striking illustrations. Dude, I went on and watched some of this.
Yeah.
It is freaking crazy, disturbing, weird.
It sure is, yeah.
It's everybody except for Hop Frog and...
I think Trippetta, there's only... Yeah, everybody's a puppet in it, right?
Yeah, except for Hop Frog and Trippetta.
Which isn't even mentioned in this comment, so you can go to YouTube, you're in for a surprise.
Yes.
Everybody are giant puppets. It's a pretty crazy adaptation. Julie Taymor is kind of known for that.
Her
But yeah, it's a good one. Thanks for recommending that, because I went and watched it, and it was... It's nuts.
It's pretty cool.
Eldritch Scary writes, Rita Rudner is thin and a genius, as Chris said in that episode. And it's proven literally this week on WTF. Apparently she was a guest on Mark Maron's show.
Yes.
Just glad that Chan and Chris's abilities to kill people they reference hasn't affected Miss Rudner.
Oh, jeez.
I don't think we have that power. Oh, but that was a weird synchronicity, huh? You mentioned. Did you know that when you mentioned it?
No, I didn't. No. I was just thinking of awesome comedians that were thin, and she's at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Jason Thompson says, a bit random here, but Hop Frog is from some barbarous region where there are orangutans. Are we supposed to get the impression that Hop Frog and Trippetta are people of color? Of course, I know Poe was personally racist, so any intentional anti-racist message is highly dubious, but I wonder if there is an implication here.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they're just, it's kind of fantasy world, isn't it? Like, I don't really feel that it's necessarily rooted in any actual specific medieval place. It's like a magical land out there. Somewhere. Yeah. So, yeah, they could be of color. They could be anything.
Yeah.
David Kellogg wrote, loved this episode and the story. I think Poe draws from the Odyssey in the setup to the revenge. Yeah. I recently read Emily Wilson's excellent translation of the Odyssey, and the scene where Odysseus gets revenge is very similarly set up.
Oh.
There's a ruse to get all the weapons out of the room. They're sent away to be cleaned, and the doors are all locked. Then there's a game. As everybody knows, the contest is string the bow and shoot through some axe heads. As in Poe, the people about to be slaughtered are disarmed both physically and psychologically by the distraction of the event.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it probably is an allusion to that.
I didn't
and then also that. On that episode, we had a lot of great comments in support of bringing back Bruce Green as a reader. So folks seem to like Bruce, and so do we.
I don't like Bruce. I love him.
I do too.
The cast of Amontillado. Aaron Gardner writes, I'd read the crap out of Cosmo if there are any revenge tales. How to please your man / dismember his body if he crosses you. Who wants to start a ladies' mag with revenge tales of blood?
That would be great. Marcus Lauer writes, this story has always reminded me of Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo, another quintessential revenge tale. Interestingly, both were published in 1846. Dumas' story began serialization in 1844.
Mm.
Guess blood revenge and gruesome incarceration were in the zeitgeist back then. Yeah, I don't think they've ever gone away. I loved The Count of Monte Cristo when I read
it.
It's the best revenge tale.
So David Dean writes, one of my favorite revelations from the story that is often overlooked comes at the second to last sentence. For the half of a century, no mortal has disturbed them. In pace requiescat. He's telling the story 50 years later. He was not caught. The body and the crime were never discovered. One can assume that this is a deathbed confession. So he's just as much saying rest in peace to himself as his victim.
Oh, yeah. And we didn't really mention or focus too much on the fact that he clearly has not been caught for this.
Yeah,
he got away with it. You know, also, when I was listening to the reading, when I was editing the show, there was the line, there came forth and return only a jingling of the bells. My heart grew sick. It was the dampness of the catacombs that made it so.
Yeah.
I hastened to make an end of my labor. It was only when I heard Bob read that I realized in that moment the narrator feels a little bad.
Yeah.
He goes, my heart grew sick. And then he goes, I'm sure it was just the dampness of the catacombs. He has to like brush it off.
Yeah.
And that made the story much more chilling to me because one is tempted to think that this narrator has no conscience or feelings or is a bit of a sociopath. But when you notice that he actually is feeling bad about, he knows that what he's doing is awful. He feels a little bad about it. It makes the action a lot more sinister to me. I don't know. It brought a little extra meaning to the story there just from listening to the reading for me.
Silas Birchner writes, it is somehow comforting to know douchebags existed in the 1800s. It was a thing. As far as the insults of Fortunato, if I know my Poe, it was likely about a woman. If alcohol and douchebaggery are involved, maybe a woman was dishonored, in quotes. That kind of thing made Poe's blood boil, and his mother, Eliza, was often the target of hurtful rumors and speculation. Okay. Robert Daniel Pickard writes, I agree that snobbery in any domain is a bad thing. However, I think you're wrong about people's ability to identify a wine's vintage. My ex and her friends would every week try to stump each other with a bottle from their own collection. They would name the vineyard and year, or at least the type of grapes, and where it was grown. It was a pretty cool thing to see. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I took a position on that one, but to be honest, I hadn't really. It was more for the sake of argument. I don't really have a firm belief in what I was saying was correct. I had actually just seen like an episode of Adam Ruins Everything or something earlier in the week, and then when we were doing the story, I thought, yeah, this wine tasting stuff is stupid. A lot of people wrote in or got upset about that. But I do think that it is more about the snobbery that I was trying to get at. And sometimes people, well, this comment by Josh Decker illustrates what bothers me about it. He says,
okay.
To Chad's point, I went on a wine tour about a year ago, and one of the wineries had winemaker's notes available. I snagged one because it seriously said this. Its garnet color portends the dichotomy of youth and the complexity of age, while an alluring nose teases the senses with the intriguing spices, brambleberries, and dark fruit compote. A lively circle of black raspberry, boysenberry, date, and plum promenade around the palate on fine tannins, accompanied by coriander, cardamom, white pepper, vanilla bean, dried rose petals, a pinch of tobacco, rich, wet garden bed soil, and soft leather. He writes, rich, wet garden bed soil? Like, so your wine tastes like spicy dirt? Got it.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
A little more. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The dichotomy of youth? Come on.
Soft leather? I don't want that in my mouth.
Wait, what is the dichotomy of youth taste like?
Well, I don't know. We better get this wine and find out.
All right.
Matthew Bizzle wrote, what sommelier hurt you, Chad? Because he did get to the root of what maybe was really going on there.
Oh, poor Chad. Ben Munn says, am I the only dumbass who thought Amontillado was the main character's name as a kid? Nope, that was me. I thought the same thing. You know, Mr. Bob Amontillado owned a cask and he lured some other guy into a dungeon to see it. I'm betting I probably am. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the embarrassing admission of Ben. No, I totally thought the same thing until I read it.
You did.
Obviously.
Wow. Well, it does make sense. It is a possessive.
Yeah.
Julie Dinkins writes, it's really neat that your reader, Bob Hansky, was your high school teacher and read it aloud to you in school. Yes, it was very neat to hear him do that.
Cool.
Plus, he's a terrific reader. Agreed. The fact that the story was published in Gotti's Ladies Book reminds me of Jack London's stories, many of which were published in Cosmopolitan.
Oh.
I work in an academic library with a large Jack London collection, and students are always surprised to hear it. Wait, Cosmo? Of course, it was a different magazine back then, and it published a range of fiction by authors like Ambrose Bierce and H.G. Wells.
Wow.
So I did not know that. That kind of links us back around to the initial comment. It sounds like there might be issues of Cosmo out there with some revenge tales in them in the real world.
Wow. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. That's going to be it for this comments show. There were some interesting perspectives and interesting comments that have been coming in for the Telltale Heart.
Yes.
But we'll get to them next time. Strangely, our discussion of more men murdering, it's taking on some weird dimensions where some people are like, hey, wait a minute, women are perfectly capable of murdering. It's just funny. And then somebody else was like, that study's mean. Yeah, I don't know. It was, for something that was a toss-off comment, we're getting some pretty funny reactions to it. So
yeah, we'll talk about that on our next comment show. I want to thank everybody that wrote comments, because without you, there would be no comment show.
That's right. Keep them coming. We always love to hear from you. You guys are funny and brilliant in equal proportion. That's all we got for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comment Show.
Exclusively on Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.